We'll talk about two things today. Cricket, yes, indeed. Cricket, I have licked my wounds. I have recovered a little bit. So I can look at what's happened rationally and try and explain using some data, thanks to a wonderful statistician called Manoj Kumarji, who lives in Delhi. Thanks to him, I can give you some analysis on what is the state of Indian cricket right now and why. And second, also Pakistan. I know you might think that you've overdosed on Pakistan because last week's national interest was about Pakistan. But Pakistan is a very important country. Next door to us, what happens there is of interest to us. And something interesting has happened. So actually, I will begin with what's happened in Pakistan. My very interesting and important takeaway from Pakistan. And I'll keep it very short. So what's happened today is usually you find that when leaders of less powerful countries or poorer countries or distant countries, I would say, or not superpower countries, write op-ed articles in newspapers, they try and get them into the New York Times. So Imran Khan wrote something there, Narendra Modi wrote something there, because you want some constituency to listen to you among the big powers or at the UN, etc., etc. But in this case, Imran Khan has written an op-ed page article in one of Pakistan's own newspapers, a respected newspaper called Express Tribune. Now, this is a very interesting article. You will see a screenshot. I will share the link to the entire article with you. Now, in this article, Imran Khan pretty much lays down his agenda for Pakistan. And you know what? This is purely an agenda of Islamization. Now, is it in sync with Pakistan's constitution? Pakistan's constitution has gone through many iterations, and I think over time enough changes have been made there so you could fit in somewhere there. But the fact is that after Zia-ul-Haq talked about Nizam-e-Mustafa, this to me perhaps is the strongest agenda of Islamization, because he talks about the five principles on which Prophet Muhammad's state of Medina was based. And he now wants to rebuild Pakistan in the image of the same state of Medina. The interesting things for me, I mean, I can spend half an hour talking about this, but I will not. You will see some colleagues of mine covering it and talking about it. But the most important thing for me is how he begins it. He said, nations can die easily because nations can be destroyed, nations can be broken, but civilizations don't die easily. So when I read that, I thought, what civilization is he talking about? Is he talking about the Indus Valley civilization? Is he talking about the Indian civilization? Obviously, he will not. Is he talking about the subcontinental civilization? No, he's doing nothing of the sort. He's talking about Islamic civilization. So he is now resetting Pakistan and Pakistani nationalism purely in the Islamic framework. This is not the framework of Pakistani constitutional nationalism of the kind that Muhammad Ali Jinnah might have imagined. He did set up a state for Muslims. He did believe in the two-nation theory. But did he set up Pakistan in the parameters of Islamic civilization? I don't believe so. But that's what Imran Khan does. Now he goes on to say that this new state of his dreams, or what agenda he's giving to Pakistan, should follow the core spiritual principles of Prophet Muhammad's Medina. Because he says, when does a civilization die? Civilization does not die easily, but a civilization dies when it loses its core spiritual principles, when it gets weakened spiritually. Again, very important. And I'll take you back to the summer of 1991. There was a big debate in Pakistan after Benazir Bhutto gave a speech at the Pakistani, I think it was at their defense college, at the defense staff college, or maybe it was their equivalent of National Defense College, where Benazir Bhutto, then as prime minister, gave a speech saying that armies are never guardians of ideological frontiers of the state. Armies can be guardians of the territorial frontiers of the state. When she said that, everybody thought she was now heading for trouble. Her rationale was good. She said if armies could guard the ideological frontiers of the state, then Soviet Union would not have broken down. But in this case, Pakistani army does believe that they are guardians of the ideological frontiers of the state. And when she made that speech, it was generally understood that her days were numbered, that she'd got carried away or her speechwriter had got carried away. And sure enough, before much time had passed, she had lost her job. Now Imran Khan is redefining Pakistan as an ideological state. Pakistan always was an ideological state, but now he is trying to redefine it. He's trying to redefine it purely in Islamic terms, and he wants to take it back to Prophet Muhammad's sort of vision of the state of Medina. Now, he says that, you know, you have to have unity, justice, rule of law. Rule of law leads to meritocracy. He's counting the five principles, five core spiritual principles of the state of Medina. Unity, justice, rule of law, which leads to meritocracy, strong moral and ethical foundation for which he is now starting this religious education, etc., etc., inclusivity, and quest for knowledge. And then he says, we now have to help revive the covenant of Medina in Pakistan, for which he said he set up a new authority. It's called NRA, which is National Rahmatul Lil Alameen Authority, which is the authority that will teach people more about the values of Prophet Muhammad's life, his teachings. So basically build a more theological basis of his society, his republic and his country. Then he goes on to say, where do you learn from? Rule of law. He said there are good examples in Eastern Asia. Right? Don't go look at the West. Eastern Asia, he doesn't like the West very much. He says that again and again. Japan, South Korea, China. These are the three examples of rule of law. What should not be the rule of law? Surprise, surprise. He quotes the example of India. So he says in India, there is an apartheid implementation of the rule of law. That's why India has quote unquote extreme poverty and also many insurgencies which are threatening to break India apart. Of course, apne girebaan mein jhaanki, but anyway, I'm just quoting from his article and telling you what his thought process is. Then I'll tell you in 1 minute where I think it's coming from. Then he says also that welfare systems, welfare state. Prophet Muhammad had a welfare state in Medina. So he says a good example is the Scandinavian countries. They've built a robust welfare state, but then the kind of welfare state the Western world has is not possible in our kind of countries, he says, because that's based on too much consumption. And if you set up welfare states on that kind of consumption, you will need the resources, his words, not mine, of seven earths of the size that we have. So obviously, he says, live more frugally, live more modestly. Now, you forget all that. What's he, where is he coming from? When people make this kind of agenda shifts or changes, or when someone like Imran Khan, who had projected himself as a force of modernization to begin with, he's now taking you back 13 centuries back or 14 centuries back. That happens when you are in trouble. Because when you are in trouble, it was always said that patriotism is the refuge of the scoundrel, but also religion is the refuge of the beleaguered politician. So he is today beleaguered. His popularity is down. His inflation is rising. His army is at his throat because they want him to do certain things that he knows if he does will weaken him. He sees Nawaz Sharif's party rising. He's lost some provincial elections. So in this process, what has he done? Because he is facing this crisis, he is now seeking refuge in religion. It is no different from what many other rulers in a similar kind of situation might have done. You've seen in Turkey, for example, his BFF, best friend, Turkey, given how inflation is rising there at one point, lately it's been 36%. There also, Erdogan is seeking refuge in religion, and that is what he seems to be doing. Now the question is, how will the army respond to this? How will the other political parties respond to this? What happens usually in Pakistan is that once you talk about Islamic values, Islamization, etc., everybody gets into a competitive spirit. And instead of saying that this is not the right way to go, because there are no Ataturks in Pakistan anymore and Ataturk cannot survive in Pakistan, instead of saying that, look, you're going too far with religion, everybody starts to pretending to go even faster. So if that happens, I'm seeing a lot of debate in the Pakistani media, then perhaps Tehreek-e-Labbaik would think, Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, we've talked about those Maulanas several times, they will think maybe that we are now irrelevant, right? These guys are just carrying out our agenda. So our job is done. This article is a significant statement from Imran Khan, so I thought I will talk about it in some limited detail, which I have done. Now look at cricket. Now cricket, you see, India has been number one for some time in Test cricket. Lately, it's declined a bit. We've missed that decline simply because we won some series. We won some series at home. We beat New Zealand at home 1-0. We had beaten England. We beaten everybody at home anyway, but you also beat England in England 2-1. One test match remains to be played in lieu of the match that wasn't played at Manchester. But we beat England in England. We beaten Australia twice in Australia. We just failed to conquer the final frontier, which is beating South Africa in South Africa. This was our best opportunity, but we blew it. Now, what is it that lies behind it? If you look at the data, and as I told you, I've got a lot of this data thanks to Mr. Manoj Kumar. So the big difference that came about in Indian cricket, so it became a world beater. Before 1995, Indian cricket was mostly losing. There was the odd flash in the pan. There was 1983, of course, the World Cup victory wasn't followed up with very much more similar victories. Before that, there was the 1971-72 period when you won series in England and the West Indies, or West Indies and England, in that order. But otherwise, Indian cricket mostly was struggling. And if we won the odd test match overseas, it was a very big deal. From 95 onwards, things began to change. And why did things begin to change then? Because 95 onwards, India saw the rise of the Indian batting power. Indian batting power, there was Sachin before that. Before Sachin, there was Gavaskar. But what happened in those periods was that in Gavaskar's period or in Sachin's period, India had only one batsman averaging more than 50 over a substantial period of time or a substantial number of test matches. So when Gavaskar was averaging 50, there was Vengsarkar in early 40s. There was Mahendra Amarnath in early 40s. There was Vishwanath for some time in early 40s, but nobody else in 50s. Usually a top batsman in the world will average above 50. So if you have one batsman only averaging above 50, you're really not a batting power. In 1996, then, in the series in England, we saw the rise of Sourav Ganguly and Rahul Dravid. And Indian batting began to change. And then we had the arrival of Virender Sehwag. So see what happened between 1995 and 2005. 10 years, a 10-year epoch, India became a great batting power. So Rahul Dravid in that period played 93 test matches, scored 7,980 runs at the average of 57.83. And go on like that. You will see the data on my screen. I will not waste your time repeating it. But Tendulkar, in the same period, played 91 test matches, averaged 58.07. Sehwag, in the same period, he came a bit later, but played 38 test matches at 53.95. That's almost 54. So India had three batsmen in substantially above 50, averaging substantially above 50. That's a batting superpower. And if that wasn't just enough, you had VVS Lakshman at about 44 and Sourav Ganguly at about 41. That became a solid batting power. And in between came in Gautam Gambhir, who made this the most formidable batting lineup in the world. What happened in that period was we saw some great successes. We saw the big turnaround in Kolkata at Eden Gardens in 2001 against Australia. That's where I say this epoch, the winning epoch, rising epoch of Indian cricket began, which seems to be fading right now. And I will tell you why it seems to be fading. Now, that was in many ways a batting victory. That's because VVS Lakshman and Rahul Dravid played that incredible partnership. And after that, you saw that batting power rise. In fact, it peaked in 2004 in Sydney when India scored 705 for something declared against Australia. That was the peak of the Indian batting power. But the important thing to note is that with that batting power, India was able to win some tests overseas. It was able to draw some series overseas, but it wasn't able to win any series overseas. When I say overseas, I mean in what is called as SENA countries. That is South Africa, England, New Zealand, Australia. Again, in that period, look at India's bowling. India always had one good fast bowler at least, right? So there was Srinath, who played 52 tests in the same period, got 195 wickets at 28.96 average and 10 times a 5-wicket haul. Then you had Zaheer Khan, who played 40 tests, Venkatesh Prasad, 33 tests. They had 111 and 96 wickets respectively, and average per wicket of 36.25, 35.20. Srinath and Venkatesh Prasad for some time bowled in tandem. But you never had two or three fast bowlers at the same time. Of course, you had marvelous spin bowlers. You had the great Anil Kumble and Harbhajan Singh. But that is why you got much better success at home then, because you had very decent pace and you had great spin bowling and fantastic batting, but did not win overseas, because spin may occasionally win you a test or maybe even a series overseas, but mostly it cannot do so. I will not say never does so, because otherwise we would not have won those series in the West Indies and in England in 1971-72. That was mostly through spin. Now you come later and you see what's happened lately. Last 5 years. If look at the last 5 years, then I would cut it down even further. I'll make it the last 3 years. Until 18-19, India was really rising. That's when India had our first series victory in Australia. Now, if you look at the data which I have from Manoj, from January 1, 2019 to January 16, 2022, that is till the end of the South Africa series, till the end of the last test match in South Africa. India has played 50 test matches in this period, scored 13,915 runs, lost 424 wickets, and averaged 32.82. That is 32.82 runs scored per wicket lost. This is not the tops in the world. In last 3 years, India have declined. It was the tops earlier, and I will give you some more data. Australia, on the other hand, has had an average, which is runs scored per wicket lost in the same period, of 37.41. That is way ahead of India. Again, New Zealand in the same period, 37.12. Again, way ahead of India. Which means India's batting power has declined over the past 3 years. Now, that is not to say that everybody else is ahead of India. India is still ahead of England, which is 27.51, and South Africa, which is 26.51. So it's not as if South Africa cricket is in the pink of health. It is just that Indian batting has declined year on year for the past 3 years. You want to see it more granularly, I must give the credit where it's due. So this is an article by Amit Chaudhary in Economic Times this Sunday. In that article, there is marvelous data, because he's cut it down in a granular manner. And I will tell you, if you look at India's batting average, that is runs scored per wicket lost, for the past 5 years, India's batting average was 32.14, compared to the rest of the world, which is 28.34, right? 4 years back, India was 30.17 and the world was 27.78. So until 3 years back, India was the tops in the world. 3 years back, India was 30.27 and rest of the world was 28.41. So India's batting average, runs scored per wicket loss, was the highest in the world, and India was the world number one team. Since then, suddenly Indian batting has slipped. So say if you look at 2 years back, India's average run scored per wicket fell to 25.41 and world average was 27.96. So 2 years back, after 3 years, if you count from 5 years, after year 5, 4, 3, in year 2, India's batting average went below the rest of the world. The following year, which is last year, it fell even further. or stayed sort of thereabouts, but stayed below the rest of the world. So 26.60. So once again, India suffered because India's batting has declined. Again, from the same article by Amit Chaudhary, we see data on the batting average for number 3 and 5 batsmen. That means in India's case, Pujara, Kohli and Rahane. 3-5, that is the essential, that's the core of your batting after the openers have dealt with the new ball. So 5 years back, India's 3-4-5 averaged 40.3. Rest of the world's 3-4-5 averaged 35.84. 2 years back, this continued like this, and 3 years back, it began to decline. 3 years back, India became 34.37 and rest of the world was 36.34. So India declined 3 years back. 2 years back, decline became more pronounced. It's 28.65 for India, 36 for the rest of the world. That's a big decline, big difference. Now it is 28 for India and approximately 34 for the rest of the world. So once again, where India has really suffered is in the loss of form by its number 3 to number 5. That is Pujara, Kohli and Rahane. So that is the big difference. And you can also see this in India's larger performance. For example, the series of 18-19 that India won in Australia, who was the man of the series? It was Chiteshwar Pujara. That also reminds you that until then, India's 3-4-5 still had the power, which has now been lost. So when Indian team gets down to reconstructing itself now, it needs to focus on the batting, because what India has right now, it has a set of marvelous fast bowlers. So at any given time, India can field 4 great fast bowlers. The problem is they can't always bail you out if you score too little, as we have done in South Africa, or exactly as we had done in that World Test Championship final in Southampton.